Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, November 27th, 2021 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today we will be reading from the following main articles. New COVID-19 variant. World races to stop Omicron. WHO calls strain a highly transmissible virus of concern, by Raf Kasert and Calvin Woodward. Biden sets out oil gas leasing reform, stops short of ban, by Matthew Daly. Front Range retailers hope for a brighter shopping season, by Judith Kohler. University of Colorado research, Black Twitter, the Modern Day Green Book, by Elizabeth Hernandez. And following up with miscellaneous articles. New COVID-19 variant. World races to stop Omicron. WHO calls strain a highly transmissible virus of concern, by Raf Kasert and Calvin Woodward, the Associated Press. Brussels. Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, the world raced Friday to contain a new coronavirus variant, potentially more dangerous than the one that has fueled relentless waves of infection on nearly every continent. A World Health Organization panel named the variant Omicron and classified it as a highly transmissible virus of concern, the same category that includes the predominant Delta variant, which is still a scourge driving higher cases of sickness and death in Europe and parts of the United States. It seems to spread rapidly, U.S. President Joe Biden said of the new variant, only a day after celebrating the resumption of Thanksgiving gatherings for millions of American families and the sense that normal life was coming back, at least for the vaccinated. In announcing new travel restrictions, he told reporters, "I've decided that we're going to be cautious." Omicron's actual risks are not understood, but early evidence suggests it carries an increased risk of reinfection compared with other highly transmissible variants, the WHO said. That means people who contracted COVID-19 and recovered could be subject to catching it again. It could take weeks to know if current vaccines are less effective against it. In response to the variant's discovery in southern Africa, the United States, Canada, Russia, and a host of other countries joined the European Union in restricting travel for visitors from that region, where the variant brought on a fresh surge of infections. The White House said the U.S. will restrict travel from South Africa and 7 other countries in the region beginning Monday. Biden said that means no travel to or from the designated countries except for returning U.S. citizens and permanent residents who test negative. Medical experts, including the WHO, warned against any overreaction before the variant was thoroughly studied. But a jittery world feared the worst after the tenacious virus triggered a pandemic that has killed more than 5 million people around the globe. "We must move quickly and at the earliest possible moment," British Health Secretary Sajid Javid told lawmakers. Omicron has now been seen in travelers to Belgium, Hong Kong, and Israel, as well as in southern Africa. There was no immediate indication whether the variant causes more severe disease. As with other variants, some infected people display no symptoms, South African experts said. The WHO panel drew from the Greek alphabet in naming the variant Omicron, as it has done with the earlier major variants of the virus. Even though some of the genetic changes appear worrisome, it was unclear how much of a public health threat it posed. Some previous variants, like the Beta variant, initially concerned scientists but did not spread very far. Fears of more pandemic-induced economic turmoil caused stocks to tumble in Asia, Europe, and the United States. The Dow Jones Industrial Average briefly dropped more than 1,000 points. The S&P 500 index closed down 2.3%, its worst day since February. The price of oil plunged about 13%. The last thing we need is to bring in a new variant that will cause even more problems, German Health Minister Jens Spahn said. Members of the 27-nation EU have experienced a massive spike in cases recently. Britain, EU countries, and some others introduced their travel restrictions Friday, some within hours of learning of the variant. Asked why the U.S. was waiting until Monday, Biden said only, "Because that was the recommendation coming from my medical team." EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said flights will have to be suspended until we have a clear understanding about the danger posed by this new variant, and travelers returning from this region should respect strict quarantine rules. She warned that mutations could lead to the emergence and spread of even more concerning variants of the virus that could spread worldwide within a few months. "It's a suspicious variant," said Frank van der Broek, health minister in Belgium, which became the first European Union country to announce a case of the variant. "We don't know if it's a very dangerous variant." Omicron has yet to be detected in the United States, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, the U.S. government's top infectious disease expert. "Although it may be more transmissible and resistant to vaccines than other variants, we don't know that for sure right now," he told CNN. Speaking to reporters outside a bookstore on Nantucket Island, where he was spending the holiday weekend, Biden said the new variant was a great concern that should make clearer than ever why this pandemic will not end until we have global vaccinations. He called anew for unvaccinated Americans to get their widely available doses and for governments to waive intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines so they can be more rapidly manufactured around the world. Israel, one of the world's most vaccinated countries, announced Friday that it also detected its first case of the new variant in a traveler who returned from Malawi. The traveler and two other suspected cases were placed in isolation. Israel said all three were vaccinated, but officials were looking into the traveler's exact vaccination status. After a 10-hour overnight trip, passengers aboard KLM Flight 598 from Cape Town, South Africa, to Amsterdam were held on the edge of the runway Friday morning at Schiphol Airport for 4 hours pending special testing. Passengers aboard a flight from Johannesburg also were isolated and tested. "It's ridiculous. If we didn't catch the dreaded bug before, we're catching it now," said passenger Francesca De Medici, a Rome-based art consultant who was on the flight. Some experts said the variant's emergence illustrated how rich countries' hoarding of vaccines threatens to prolong the pandemic. Fewer than 6% of people in Africa have been fully immunized against COVID-19, and millions of health workers and vulnerable populations have yet to receive a single dose. Biden sets out oil gas leasing reform, stops short of ban. By Matthew Daly, The Associated Press, Washington. The Biden administration on Friday recommended an overhaul of the nation's oil and gas leasing program to limit areas available for energy development and raise costs for oil and gas companies to drill on public land and water. The long-awaited report by the Interior Department stops short of recommending an end to oil and gas leasing on public lands, as many environmental groups have urged. But officials said the report would lead to a more responsible leasing process that provides a better return to U.S. taxpayers. "Our nation faces a profound climate crisis that is impacting every American," Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said in a statement, adding that the new report's recommendations will mitigate worsening climate change impacts while staying steadfast in the pursuit of environmental justice. The report completes a review ordered in January by President Joe Biden, who directed a pause in federal oil and gas lease sales in his first days in office, citing worries about climate change, sharp criticism from congressional Republicans and the oil industry, even as many environmentalists and Democrats said Biden should make the leasing pause permanent. The new report seeks a middle ground that would continue the multi-billion dollar leasing program while reforming it to end what many officials consider overly favorable terms for the industry. The report recommends hiking federal royalty rates for oil and gas drilling, which have not been raised for 100 years. The federal rate of 12.5% that developers must pay to drill on public lands is significantly lower than many states and private landowners charge for drilling leases on state or private lands. The report also said the government should consider raising bond payments that energy companies must set aside for further cleanup before they drill new wells. Bond rates have not been increased in decades, the report said. The Bureau of Land Management, an Interior Department agency, should focus leasing offers on areas that have moderate to high potential for oil and gas resources and are close to existing oil and gas infrastructure, the report said. The White House declined to comment Friday, referring questions to Interior. The federal leasing program has drawn renewed focus in recent weeks as gasoline prices have skyrocketed and Republicans complain that Biden policies, including the leasing moratorium, rejection of the Keystone XL oil pipeline, and a ban on oil leasing in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, contributed to the price spike. Biden on Tuesday ordered a record 50 million barrels of oil released from America's strategic reserve, aiming to bring down gas prices amid concerns about inflation. Gasoline prices are at about $3.40 a gallon, more than 50% higher than a year ago, according to the American Automobile Association. Oil prices dropped about 13% Friday as a new coronavirus variant first detected in South Africa appeared to be spreading across the globe. The Biden administration conducted a lease sale on federal oil and gas reserves in the Gulf of Mexico last week after attorneys general from Republican-led states successfully sued in federal court to lift the suspension on federal oil and gas sales that Biden imposed when he took office. Energy companies, including Shell, BP, Chevron, and ExxonMobil, offered a combined $192 million for offshore drilling rights in the Gulf, highlighting the hurdles Biden faces to reach climate goals dependent on deep cuts in fossil fuel emissions. The leases will take years to develop, meaning oil companies could keep producing crude long past 2030, when Biden has set a goal to lower greenhouse gas emissions by at least 50% compared with 2005 levels. Scientists say the world needs to be well on the way to that goal over the next decade to avoid catastrophic climate change. Yet even as Biden has tried to cajole other world leaders into strengthening efforts against global warming, including at this month's UN climate talks in Scotland, he's had difficulty gaining ground on climate issues at home. The administration has proposed another round of oil and gas sales early next year in Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, and other states. Interior Department officials proceeded despite concluding that burning the fuels could lead to potential future climate damages. Emissions from burning and extracting fossil fuels from public lands and waters account for about a quarter of U.S. carbon dioxide emissions, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Environmentalists hailed the report's recommendation to raise royalty rates, but some groups said the report falls short of action needed to address the climate crisis. Today's report is a complete failure of the climate leadership that our world desperately needs, said Taylor McKinnon of the Center for Biological Diversity. The report presumes more fossil fuel leasing that our climate can't afford. Front Range. Retailers hope for a brighter shopping season. By Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. Area businesses that have survived the pandemic are banking on the increase in activity and travel to make this year's holiday shopping season a bit brighter. Department and big box stores offer deals on Black Friday, while local stores look forward to Small Business Saturday. The day, geared toward independent retailers and other businesses, was founded in 2010 by American Express and is co-sponsored by the U.S. Small Business Administration. Wheelhouse Gifts on Denver's South Pearl Street opened in 2020. The store, owned by Jody Fiddler, was open for Black Friday and Small Business Saturday last holiday season. But because of the pandemic, it wasn't probably as impactful as it could have been for us, said Molly Casey, an employee who is in charge of the store's social media. This year, knowing we can be fully open despite the mask mandate is really important to us. Retail analysts and trade organizations say there's a reason for optimism this year. The National Retail Federation said sales rose in October by 1.7% from September, despite ongoing labor shortages, supply chain disruptions, and rising inflation. Denver area shopping centers experienced a very significant and positive visit trend in October, according to a statement by Placer.ai, which provides analysis of foot traffic based on data from devices enabled to share the information. Data from Placer.ai showed visits in October to three metro area shopping centers, Cherry Creek in Denver, Southlands in Aurora, and Park Meadows in Lone Tree, were at or slightly above levels for the same period in 2019. October's sales numbers indicate people are responding to factors affecting retailers heading into the holidays, said Dave Bruno, director of Retail Market Insights at Aptos, a retail technology company. People are shopping early to minimize the risk of supply chain disruptions and inventory outages impacting their holiday gift giving, Bruno said in a statement. The big question, obviously, is whether much of the planned holiday buying is being done early and December sales will suffer, or if this confidence and buying power will sustain strong growth throughout the entire season. Charlotte Elitch is among Denver area business owners who hope people turn out in force to support local retailers this holiday season. I'm always optimistic. My goal is always to surpass the year before, and I'll say we always seem to have done it, except for 2020, Elitch said. Now my goal is to at least match 2019 this year. To meet that goal, Elitch will have to deal with working shorthanded, something businesses from the country's largest corporations to small mom-and-pop shops are facing as people have quit jobs or not returned after furloughs and layoffs. Elitch, who owns five Green Boxes gift shop and another store on South Pearl Street in Denver, was struggling to cover shifts when two employees recently quit. Now Elitch is working in the office during the week and working the counter on weekends. She also has to worry about staffing her store in Union Station and Lower Downtown and an outlet site on the weekends. It seems like I had a lot more applicants in past years, Elitch said. I don't have a whole lot of people applying these days. Elitch, who has weathered the ups and downs of the pandemic, has been in business for 44 years. Shauna Sankey of Colorado Springs started Black Girl Salsa in August 2020 and hopes to grow it into a full-time venture. She is encouraged by the support she sees for small businesses and campaigns such as Google's Black-Owned Friday and Small Business Saturday. It wasn't like a master plan. It just kind of fell into that situation, Sankey said of her pandemic-born pursuit. Sankey works for the Colorado Department of Corrections and had stretches with a lot of days off. After painting walls in her house and redoing furniture, Sankey decided to turn her passion for making salsa into a business. I'm a native of Pueblo. I grew up eating Mexican food and making Mexican food, learning how to cook it, Sankey said. She made her own salsa to fit her family's taste and started serving it at parties and gatherings. It was just something everyone asked for when coming over to our house, Sankey said. Her children came up with the brand name. It was probably on a Thanksgiving weekend like this, sitting at my mother's house, Sankey said, and all the kids were in the back room at the computer just looking up YouTube beats. All of a sudden I hear, "Gotta get your Black Girl Salsa." "Hey, gotta get your Black Girl Salsa." Sankey sells her salsa at area farmers markets, two restaurants, and a grocery store in Colorado Springs. She gets her ingredients from local producers. And that is the strength of small businesses, said Casey at Wheelhouse Gifts. We love being a small business in Denver and knowing that we get to offer the things that we love, Casey said. And that many of them are from other small businesses and other small artists is really, really great. University of Colorado Research. Black Twitter, The Modern Day Green Book, by Elizabeth Hernandez, The Denver Post. The Negro Motorist Green Book, first published by black postal worker Victor Green in New York in 1936, provided black readers with guidance on which businesses welcomed African Americans in a segregated United States, expanding in subsequent years with editions across the world that offered information on how to resist discrimination and violent threats. While the resource, often referred to simply as the Green Book, stopped publishing in 1966 after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, a University of Colorado researcher says the sentiment carried by that pivotal tool lives on in a modernized version, Black Twitter. Black Twitter isn't a separate version of the popular social media network, but a community of predominantly black users and allies, and sometimes internet trolls who use Twitter to talk among themselves about black culture. Doctoral student Shamika Klassen, among with CU colleagues and peers at Carnegie Mellon and Harvard Universities, analyzed more than 75,000 tweets from April and May 2020 and interviewed 18 Black Twitter users. Their research is a deep dive on how Black Twitter, which Klassen describes as an open secret waiting in plain sight for those who know how to find it, serves as an important online meeting space to explore black identity, history, culture, joy, and pain. What was most interesting to me was the many different ways that Black Twitter was giving life to people, Klassen said in an interview. There are benefits. There's empowerment. There were also people warning about racism, and it was so interesting to see all the different ways people were being fed in their spirit by Black Twitter. It's more than just funny hot takes or getting entertained by the various battles happening, but a rich, deep, meaningful community of people. Orville Rollins, a Denver resident with roots in the West Indies, said he never travels without first consulting with the community he's formed on Black Twitter. I will say I'm going to be in so-and-so an area. What should I do and where should I go? Rollins said. He agreed that Black Twitter stood in as a modern-day green book in his life. Rollins said he learned his lesson 2 years ago when he went on a business trip to Houston without consulting anyone for safety tips and ended up getting robbed. I tweeted about what happened to me, and people said, "Oh, I would have told you about that area," Rollins said. It's an informal way of keeping each other safe. In addition to safety, Rollins called on his trusted sources within the social media platform to find food flavorful enough to satisfy his cravings. People will make jokes on Twitter that these are the restaurants in the area, but this one has spices and they know how to use them, Rollins said. That might seem minor to other people, but spices are the things that make the food. Spices are what counts for us. Whenever I see a review of some small restaurant, hole in the wall, a food truck with my followers, I put more worth in that. Klassen's research noted the ways Black Twitter kept users informed about local activism and protests, particularly during Black Lives Matter protests. One interviewee was in school and watching Black Twitter as the protests were happening during the week, so when they were out of school, they knew where to go, what to bring, how to stay safe, because they had been watching up to that point, Klassen said. People were able to get this live information about the protests happening and then be able to engage in it themselves offline. Patricia Cameron, the Colorado Springs-based founder of Blackpackers, which focuses on economic equity and outdoor recreation, used Twitter to raise awareness about social justice issues such as police brutality locally and nationally, bridging gaps she said she otherwise would not have been able to in her predominantly white Colorado city. Cameron said the act of black communities building a culture inside of white spaces has existed forever, and she described the social media space as our collective consciousness. It's like a big cafeteria for us, Cameron said. Cameron said if she wants to buy something online and shop from black-owned businesses, whether it be for hair products, skincare products, or something else entirely, she will go to Twitter to ask for a recommendation. She also said she has used the platform to promote her outdoor recreation organization and found support and empowerment from black people across the country, uplifting her successes and cheering her on. It doesn't feel like I'm alone, Cameron said. Klassen said she hopes her research spurs more people to research Black Twitter and advocate for platforms such as Twitter to better support communities of color. My hope is it encourages people to explore and research Black Twitter ethically and in a way that is honoring to the people in that space, Klassen said. Congress, Boebert apologizes to Muslims for remark, by Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert apologized on Twitter on Friday morning after a video of her implying that Ilhan Omar, a fellow member of Congress and a Muslim, could be a suicide bomber circulated on the social media site on Thanksgiving. Boebert, who was elected to represent Colorado's Western 3rd Congressional District in 2020, addressed her apology to anyone in the Muslim community I offended. She added that she has reached out to Omar's office in hopes of speaking with her directly. There are plenty of policy differences to focus on without this unnecessary distraction, Boebert tweeted. Boebert has a history of using anti-Islamic language as an attack on Democrats in Congress. She repeatedly has referred to Omar and fellow Muslim U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib as members of the Jihad Squad, including in comments delivered on the House floor. The clip that circulated on Thursday took that rhetoric to a new level. Tweeted by the account @PatriotTakes, the clip shows Boebert speaking to a group on a small stage in front of an American flag. She tells the crowd she and a staffer were on an elevator in the U.S. Capitol when they saw a police officer running to catch the door before it closed. When the officer wasn't able to get on the elevator, Boebert said she turned to see Omar next to her on the elevator. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine, Boebert cracked. The line, implying Omar may have been carrying explosives, drew a round of laughter and applause from the crowd. The clip got a speedy reply from Omar, who represents Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, which includes Minneapolis. On Thursday, Omar tweeted that the elevator story was made up and Boebert is a buffoon who looks down whenever she sees Omar at the Capitol. On Friday, Omar followed up with a tweet calling on Republican congressional leaders Representative Kevin McCarthy and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to take disciplinary action against Boebert. Saying I am a suicide bomber is no laughing matter, Omar tweeted in part. Muslim bigotry has no place in Congress. Patriot Takes, which bills itself as an organization dedicated to exposing right-wing extremism in America, has called for Boebert to be stripped of her committee assignments. The organization said the video was shot at a campaign event in Pueblo. It did not respond to a Denver Post reporter seeking more information about the event. The Lauren Boebert for Congress Facebook page has posts that show Boebert was in Pueblo on November 20th and 21st for the Tanner Gun Show. A post from the 20th shows her in the same outfit she was wearing in the video. Legislature, bill would end sales tax on menstrual products, diapers, by Sasha Hindi, The Denver Post. Colorado Democratic lawmakers want the state to join the ranks of 12 other states that don't impose a sales tax on menstrual products and 15 that don't on diapers. Lawmakers had brought the state sales tax exemption proposals in 2017 as two bills, but they were unsuccessful. In 2022, some of those same backers plan to combine them. Senator Faith Winter, a Westminster Democrat, sponsored the 2017 diaper legislation, and Representative Susan Lahntein the menstrual product legislation, often referred to as the pink tax or tampon tax. They plan to lead the charge with Democratic Representative Leslie Herod of Denver and Senator Sonia Jacques-Lewis of Boulder County. Five of the states that exempt taxes on these products don't have sales taxes at all. Alaska, Delaware, Montana, New Hampshire, and Oregon. As of April, the states that exempt menstrual products specifically from state sales taxes include Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. As of July, the states that exempted diapers specifically from state sales taxation include California, Connecticut, Louisiana, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Vermont. Winter said menstrual products and diapers are essential items that lawmakers should do everything they can to make available and affordable. Their bill would include various types of feminine hygiene products, as well as diapers for babies and adults. The bill would apply only to the state's 2.9% sales tax. It would not exempt the products from municipal taxes, but cities such as Aurora and Denver have exempted feminine hygiene products from their local taxes. People have shared stories with lawmakers about children going to daycare centers with grocery bags and toilet paper as makeshift diapers and infants left in diapers longer than is healthy because families couldn't afford them. Similarly, groups across the country have been working to raise awareness about period poverty, which leads people to create makeshift items to replace pads or tampons or leave the products in too long, making themselves sick. This is actually one of the bills that's been most requested by my constituents, Winter said. Especially young women across my district are seeing this as an equity piece and as a really important way to reduce stigma. Lantine said the menstrual products bill received opposition previously, partly because of monetary concerns. While the sponsors don't have new estimates for how much tax revenue these products bring in for the state, in 2017 it was about a $3.4 million loss for diapers and about a $2.4 million loss for menstrual products. The 2022 fiscal year outlook is a lot different, Lantine said. At the time, we were literally counting pennies, and we have a lot more discretionary dollars than we've had in a long time. The other issue lawmakers who opposed the bill cited in 2017 was that the sales tax didn't exempt essential products that others use. Winter said she is open to discussing including other items in the bill. National survey results published this year found that 2 in 5 people struggled to afford menstrual products at some point in their lives. Colorado lawmakers have chipped away at the cost of menstrual products in the past. This year, they passed a bill that would create a grant program to help schools supply their bathrooms with the products to students free of charge. In 2017, lawmakers approved providing women in Colorado prisons access to free tampons. And in 2019, they passed a bill requiring jails to provide the products for free to women in custody. When it comes to diapers, a 2017 study showed that 36% of families struggled to afford them, and the need grew greater during the pandemic. Colorado lawmakers passed a bill this year to create a diaper distribution program in the Department of Human Services. Safety Patrol, head out to the highway. CDOT's Roadside Assistance Program keeps tabs on states' freeways, helping stranded motorists and at crash scenes. By John Murray, The Denver Post. The crash that hit Interstate 225 in Aurora at the height of the evening rush hour was garden variety. A sedan smashed into the back of a sport utility vehicle, and nobody was hurt. But the wreck quickly backed up northbound traffic all the same, with the heavily damaged Toyota Camry stuck, its engine dead, in one of the middle lanes near Colfax Avenue. John Boston Aubrighetti knew just what to do. Arriving before police, the CDOT Safety Patrol driver first checked to make sure no one was hurt. Then he used his specially outfitted Ford F-250 pickup to nudge the Camry to the shoulder where it joined the Jeep that had been hit. Traffic was moving in all four lanes within 5 minutes. Patrollers in the Colorado Department of Transportation's Roadside Assistance Program have kept tabs on a growing network of Metro Denver and Colorado highways for 29 years, offering free help to stranded motorists while assisting authorities at crash scenes. The Safety Patrol recently added new routes in Denver to its network and signed up a new sponsor, the Geico Insurance Company, which will contribute $550,000 a year toward the program's $6.5 million budget, CDOT says. Alberghetti's response on I-225 on the recent Monday evening prioritized safety and speed because a quicker clearance of the highway lessens the chances for another crash. He left broken glass and debris on the pavement, but the people involved in the crash were safely on the shoulder. If the stalled car was in the left lane or right lane, not in the middle, I would have kept the lane shut down with my cones and I would have swept the debris up, said Alberghetti, 50, a no-nonsense Army reservist with a Boston accent whose nickname was inspired by his upbringing there. But people just want to go. I want to open it up quick and fast, get people going. Safety Patrol drivers don't investigate crashes or issue tickets, but they do help responding state troopers and police officers with traffic control and safety. They also can clear most anything that's blocking the highway, whether it's a car, a large appliance that has fallen off a truck, or even an 18-wheeler, which takes two safety patrol drivers working in tandem, Alberghetti said. For 3 years, he has been the operational manager for Incident Clear, CDOT's safety patrol contractor. Its drivers assist more than 40,000 motorists a year, CDOT says. Between crash responses and helping drivers who need a flat tire changed, a jump start, extra fuel, or lockout assistance. When needed, the program's towing partner provides free tows to safe, well-lit locations off the highway. We see accidents happen right in front of us. Alberghetti was joined by a Denver Post reporter and photographer on that Monday in early November as he drove nearly 100 miles of Metro Denver highways in 3.5 hours. As Alberghetti drove, he kept an eye out for collisions and for vehicles pulled over on the shoulders. So as I'm looking, I'm not only looking at this side of the highway, I'm looking at that side too, he said as he neared the 6th Avenue exit on Interstate 25 near downtown. Because an accident may happen before CDOT or everybody else knows about it. We see accidents happen right in front of us. The afternoon had started quietly. Alberghetti's first stop was on Interstate 70 near Sheridan Boulevard, where officers were responding to a car traveling the wrong direction in the eastbound lanes. He stopped in the left lane, his truck's yellow emergency lights flashing, and placed cones to block it off for extra safety. The driver turned out to be an older man who entered on the wrong ramp. By then, he had pulled over on the inside shoulder and was talking with the officers. Alberghetti said they asked family members to come and drive the man home. A half hour later, while driving on I-25 near University Boulevard, Alberghetti spotted police and a CDOT incident management crew on the other side of the highway. He exited and turned back. They were managing traffic for a food truck that was stranded and blocking the right lane after its back axle busted, throwing the wheels out of alignment. But this time, there was nothing for him to do because the truck was upright and couldn't move on its tires. If it had overturned and it's sitting out there, then boom, we will push it, he said. Instead, Denver police called in a flatbed truck. New patrols added on I-270, I-76. The safety patrol has nearly 24 trucks stocked with equipment, extra gas, and cleanup materials. Its drivers patrol Interstates 25, 70, and 225, as well as the 6th Avenue Freeway and C-470 in the Denver area, stretches of I-25 near Colorado Springs and Fort Collins, and I-70 in the mountains between Golden and Vail. In mid-November, the safety patrol added new regular patrols on Interstates 76 and 270 in Metro Denver. Most shifts cover the morning and evening rush hours, but some safety patrol drivers roam the highways during off-peak hours and on weekends, especially on the I-70 mountain stretch. They operate everywhere except construction zones, which have their own safety crews. I really want to tell people, Alberghetti said, that if you see one of our trucks, move out of the way because there is something hindering and stopping you from going home to your family, going to work, going out on a hot date or something, and the safety patrol can get traffic moving again. The Navy veteran lives in Castle Rock and is in the Army Reserves. He said his most recent deployment was in the last year at the U.S. military's detention camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He worked in security at Lockheed Martin's Jefferson County campus, he said, before joining Incident Clear and the Safety Patrol. 5 years from retirement, he says he enjoys overseeing the patrol crews while driving routes himself occasionally. It's a job that brings gratitude from the people helped by the patrol drivers, but the job also comes with its share of dangers, despite extensive training aimed at minimizing safety risks while working in traffic. Safety patrol drivers also might be the first ones to arrive at a fatal crash scene, an incident that's more likely to shut down a highway while it's sorted out. The driver's pay starts at $18 an hour and increases by $1 each year, Alberghetti said, with drivers eligible for safety bonuses. For some, the variety is appealing. Drivers see similar patterns of crashes and roadside breakdowns, but each day brings a reshuffled deck, with winter storms throwing an extra wild card into the mix. What's today, Monday? Alberghetti said, noting it had been relatively tame. It's a free-for-all on Fridays, reducing the risk of more crashes. The quiet afternoon would soon give way to a flurry of radio traffic after 5 p.m. as rush hour traffic grew denser. But before that happened, Alberghetti talked about how the safety patrol responds to crashes. There's a reason the drivers move quickly, with the program touting an average clearance time of less than 12 minutes. As traffic backs up and drivers slam on the brakes, each minute brings a greater risk of another crash. Alberghetti took the ramp from C-470 back onto I-70 as the sun was setting. He passed the stretch in Lakewood where the driver of a runaway semi-trailer crashed into stopped traffic in April 2019, setting off a fiery chain reaction pileup involving 28 vehicles. Four people died, and the driver recently was convicted of vehicular homicide. The tragedy was a secondary crash, Alberghetti pointed out. That traffic was stopped because of a less severe crash involving a car, a semi-trailer, and a school bus that happened 5 miles up the highway in Wheat Ridge about an hour earlier. Clearing that one was more complicated than a fender bender, but he said the time it took prompted hindsight discussions within CDOT and the safety patrol that underlined the importance of clearing most crashes quickly to lessen the traffic backup. If we had moved that quicker, Alberghetti speculated, perhaps the semi-trailer driver in the fatal crash could have slowed down just with his gears and made it all the way down to here and gotten his truck under control. At 5:15 p.m., soon after turning south on I-225 on the other side of the Denver area, Alberghetti spotted the aftermath of a fresh two-car crash, the one involving the Camry and the Jeep on the northbound side. After turning around at Colfax, he arrived and got to work, clearing the Camry from the middle of the highway within minutes. After he departed, the radio popped with reports of other drivers responding to a four-car crash on 6th Avenue at Wadsworth, a crash on I-25 at Colfax, one near I-25 and 58th Avenue, and another on I-25 in Castle Rock. Obituary. Towering musical theater master Sondheim dies at 91. By Mark Kennedy, The Associated Press. New York, Stephen Sondheim, the songwriter who reshaped the American musical theater in the second half of the 20th century with his intelligent, intricately rhymed lyrics, his use of evocative melodies, and his willingness to tackle unusual subjects, has died. He was 91. Sondheim influenced several generations of theater songwriters, particularly with such landmark musicals as Company, Follies, and Sweeney Todd, which are considered among his best work. His most famous ballad, Send in the Clowns, has been recorded hundreds of times, including by Frank Sinatra and Judy Collins. The artist refused to repeat himself, finding inspiration for his shows in such diverse subjects as an Ingmar Bergman movie, A Little Night Music, the opening of Japan to the West, Pacific Overtures, French painter George Seurat, Sunday in the Park with George, Grimm's Fairy Tales, Into the Woods, and even the killers of American presidents, Assassins, among others. The theater has lost one of its greatest geniuses, and the world has lost one of its greatest and most original writers. Sadly, there is now a giant in the sky, producer Cameron McIntosh wrote in tribute. Six of Sondheim's musicals won Tony Awards for Best Score, and he also received a Pulitzer Prize for Sunday in the Park with George, an Academy Award for the song Sooner or Later from the film Dick Tracy, 5 Olivier Awards, and the Presidential Medal of Honor. In 2008, he received a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. Sondheim's music and lyrics gave his shows a dark, dramatic edge, whereas before him, the dominant tone of musicals was frothy and comic. He was sometimes criticized as a composer of unhummable songs, a badge that didn't bother Sondheim. Early in his career, Sondheim wrote the lyrics for two shows considered to be classics, West Side Story, 1957, and Gypsy, 1959. West Side Story, with music by Leonard Bernstein, transplanted Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet to the streets of modern-day New York. Gypsy, with music by Julie Stein, told the backstage story of the ultimate stage mother and the daughter who grew up to be Gypsy Rose Lee. Saving History with Sandbags, Climate Change Threatens Smithsonian Artifacts, by Christopher Flavelle, The New York Times. Washington, President Warren Harding's blue silk pajamas, Muhammad Ali's boxing gloves, the Star-Spangled Banner, scripts from the television show MASH, nearly 2 million irreplaceable artifacts that tell the American story are housed in the National Museum of American History, part of the Smithsonian Institution, the biggest museum complex in the world. Now, because of climate change, the Smithsonian stands out for another reason. Its cherished buildings are extremely vulnerable to flooding, and some eventually could be underwater. 11 palatial Smithsonian museums and galleries form a ring around the National Mall. The grand 2-mile park, lined with elms that stretches from the Lincoln Memorial to the U.S. Capitol. But that land was once marsh, and as the planet warms, the buildings face two threats. Rising seas eventually will push in water from the tidal Potomac River and submerge parts of the mall, scientists say. More immediately, increasingly heavy rainstorms threaten the museums and their priceless holdings, particularly because many are stored in basements. At the American History Museum, water is intruding. It gurgles up through the floor in the basement. It finds the gaps between ground-level windows, puddling around exhibits. It sneaks into the ductwork, then meanders the building and drips onto display cases. It creeps through the ceiling in locked collection rooms, thief-like, and pools on the floor. Staff members have been experimenting with defenses, candy-red flood barriers lined up outside windows, sensors that resemble electronic mousetraps deployed throughout the building that trigger alarms when wet, plastic bins on wheels filled with a version of cat litter to be rushed back and forth to soak up the water. So far, the museum's holdings have escaped damage, but we're kind of in trial and error, said Ryan Doyle, a facilities manager at the Smithsonian. It's about managing water. An assessment of the Smithsonian's vulnerabilities, released last month, reveals the scale of the challenge. Not only are artifacts stored in basements in danger, but floods could knock out electrical and ventilation systems in the basements that keep the humidity at the right level to protect priceless art, textiles, documents, and specimens on display. Of all its facilities, the Smithsonian ranks American history as the most vulnerable, followed by its next-door neighbor, the National Museum of Natural History. Scientists at the nonprofit group Climate Central expect some land around the two museums will be underwater at high tide if average global temperatures rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial levels. The planet has warmed by 1.1 degrees Celsius and is on track to rise 3 degrees by 2100. Smithsonian officials want to build floodgates and other defenses and move some collections to a proposed site in suburban Maryland, but Congress has yet to fund many of those efforts, and the changes would take years to implement. Until then, the Smithsonian struggles with this fact. An institution that is beloved by the public, well-funded, and staffed by top experts is protecting the nation's treasures with sandbags and garbage cans. We follow rain like you wouldn't believe, said Nancy Bechtol, head of facilities for the Smithsonian. We're constantly watching those weather forecasts to know whether we've got one coming. On a recent morning, a group of employees gathered in the entrance hall of the American History Museum to point out the places where the water comes in. The hall featured a wooden cotton planter used by a South Carolina tenant farmer, a super surfer skateboard ridden by Patty McGee, the first female professional skateboarder, the cream-colored Fender Esquire that Steve Cropper played when he recorded Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding. Definitely, where we're standing could flood, Bechtol said. She fears a massive storm that lingers, the way Hurricane Harvey smothered Houston in 2017 or Ida inundated New York City this summer. The History Museum sits on what used to be the Tiber Creek, which was filled in during the 1800s. The building manager, Mark Proctor, led the group to Southern Railway 1401, a towering steam locomotive made in 1926. The train sits by a window that looks out onto a garden on the building's east side. In March, a storm flooded the garden. Water came through the window and pooled around 1401's steel wheels. We had to wet vac the water out, Proctor said. Outside, workers pushed flood barriers against the windows to slow the water the next time it floods. Proctor took a freight elevator to the basement, then entered a room that holds electrical and HVAC equipment that form the building's life support system. Without it, the air would turn hot and humid, damaging the collections. Next to the mechanical room, Robert Horton stopped at a locked door. Horton is assistant director for collections and archives. His favorite item at American History is a homemade prosthetic leg made by a coal miner around 1950. After passing his badge over an electronic sensor, Horton entered a small room with a low ceiling packed tight with cabinets that held exquisite pieces of porcelain. All the way back to, you know, the invention of porcelain, he said. When the building was opened in 1964, the basement was not designed to store collections, Horton said, but as the museum's holdings grew, it filled up. Horton walked to the corner of the room where water had come through the ceiling during the March storm. Residue from the water was still visible. Plastic sheeting had been draped atop one cabinet, positioned to direct leaks into a garbage can. Around it were dark squares of fabric designed to absorb the water that the garbage can missed. Since we are afraid that it may happen again, we've left a lot of the protective material in place, Horton said. Down the hall, another chamber's shelves were stacked from floor to ceiling with boxes made of treated paperboard that Horton said were designed to repel water. They were filled with vaudeville scripts, the papers of Lenora Slaughter, who ran the Miss America pageant from 1941 to 1967, and records from the Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps, including a box marked Poems of the CCC. Responsibility for controlling flooding on the Mall is split among several entities, including the National Park Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, the District of Columbia's Water Utility, and the National Capital Planning Commission, said Julia Koster, Chief of Public Engagement for the Commission. There's the need to kind of figure out who should lead the charge on this, Koster said. The Smithsonian, which gets more than half of its funding from Congress and the rest from private sources, repeatedly has requested money from the government since 2015 to start work on a $160 million storage site in Suitland, Maryland, for items from the American History Museum and the National Gallery of Art. So far, the Smithsonian has put $6 million toward the new storage facility. Construction has yet to begin. The Smithsonian is seeking an additional $500,000 to begin work on a separate $39 million plan for flood walls and other changes to fortify the American History Museum. That project is in early planning stages, said Linda St. Thomas, a Smithsonian spokesperson. Some other Smithsonian museums are further ahead. The National Air and Space Museum will install floodgates as part of a multi-year renovation expected to total more than $1 billion. The mall's newest addition, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, was built with three massive pumps to keep its lower levels from filling with groundwater. Meanwhile, the holdings at American History Museum await a solution. I don't want to rush, said Bechtel, noting that relocating collections required not only planning and building a new facility, but also careful handling each item. We can only really do so much, I guess, and do it carefully and do it well. Steamboat opens Saturday. A tiny fraction of skiable terrain will be available. By John Meyer, The Denver Post. Steamboat Resort will open for skiing and riding on Saturday, and Beaver Creek is expected to open on Monday, bringing the number of Colorado ski areas in operation to 15. Both Steamboat and Beaver Creek had to postpone their previously scheduled openings due to mild weather. Steamboat was scheduled to open November 20th, and Beaver Creek was scheduled to open this past Wednesday. Steamboat will open 5 trails on 20 acres. That's less than 1% of the resort's total skiable acres of 2,965. This has been a particularly dry and warm preseason, Dave Hunter, Steamboat's vice president of resort operations, said in a news release. Snowmaking depends on wet bulb temperatures, which is a combination of temperatures and low humidity to create the ideal temperature for mimicking Mother Nature. Our five-year average wet bulb temperature is 15 degrees, and this season our average wet bulb temperature has been 20 degrees. Those extra 5 degrees make a huge difference. Ideal snowmaking conditions range between 12 to 18 degrees. We've asked a lot of our snowmakers, and they have stepped up to the challenge. Crested Butte, which opened Wednesday, has 9 of 150 trails in operation. Aspen opened Thursday with 10 of its 87 trails, and nearby Snowmass opened a small learner area. Beaver Creek spokeswoman Rachel Levitsky said Beaver Creek is now targeting Monday for opening day. Thank you for joining us for the reading of the Saturday, November 27th, 2021 Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County want some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that the University of Colorado School of Pharmacy provides prescription drug counseling? They will provide individualized prescription drug phone counseling by appointment following their educational programs. Call 1-866-294-3971 to schedule an appointment. The Audio Information Network of Colorado would like to acknowledge the generous contributions of the Denver Foundation. Thank you for your support. If you have questions about our many audio information services, please call us at 303-786-7777. Look us up online at aincolorado.org. Thank you for listening.